So we are in Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, the very beginning of the Perek. We had started to introduce the story of this fellow named Yiftach. We noted the Gemara's treatment of Yiftach that said that he's a lightweight, and yet he carries the same authority as a heavyweight because he's the shofet for his time. We give two different explanations. Either, if he has a position of authority, he must have something to him. And that's borne out by the fact that we do take the position seriously of anybody who is appointed to represent the community. And Abarbanel seems to support that. And then on the other hand, the view that, no, he's not so great, but honestly, we need a leader, and there's nobody else. And we supported that with the Sefer HaChinuch, brought the Medrash and Bereishis Rabbah about how he refuses to go to Pinchas. There's some bad behavior that we'll be reading about in our story itself. So, let's start on Yiftach himself and see what we can do. I think we actually read the opening psukim. We read the opening sentences here. V'yiftach ha-geladi haya gibor chayil. He was gibor chayil, which we take to mean not necessarily a good man, but a powerful one. The word chayil is vague and can mean many different things, but when you pair it up with gibor, it suggests strength. V'hu ben isha zona. We said that he was the son of a zona. We're going to come back to that. V'yolad Gilad is Yiftach. This fellow Gilad was the father of Yiftach. V'atayladeshes Gilad lo banim. But Gilad also has sons via his wife, as opposed to the zonah. V'yigdalu b'nei ha'isha, and they grew up. V'yigarshu es Yiftach, and they kicked him out. V'yamrulolos n'chal v'beis avinu. They said, you're not inheriting with us. Ki ben isha charezata, you're from some other woman. Literally. Vayivrach Yiftach mipnei Achav vayeshev beretz Tov. He runs away to the land of Tov. We noted the view of the Chidah, that this actually speaks in favor of Yiftach. He doesn't want to fight. He runs away. He goes outside of Eretz Yisrael in order to go to a place where he won't have a mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel, of going to Yerushalayim for the holidays, and therefore he won't meet his brothers, and there won't be any animosity. And unfortunately, we know families like this, where it's just like, you go your way, I'll go my way. We don't have to see each other, and that'll be that. But he does develop a fan club. The Anashim Reikim, empty people. And that was really the last thing that we had talked about. But let's go back to the story of Yiftach's mother. Radak presents multiple views of this woman in source number 2. Ben Pilegesh Gilad Haya. He was the son of Gilad's concubine. Now, concubine and zonah are two different things. Concubine is a legitimate relationship. V'nikreit zonah l'fi she'ena im ba'ala b'ksuba v'kidushin. She's called a zonah because she doesn't have a ksuba from her husband. She doesn't have kidushin. V'kamo ha-zonah, she's like the zonah. V'ahal pi shemiyuchad eslo, even if she is monogamous. And the idea here is that a concubine relationship in halacha, they're subject to some debate, but as the Gemara seems to frame it, does not have a ksuba, and does not have the formal kiddushin ceremony, and as a result, the marriage can end fairly easily. It's not a marriage. The concubinage can, if that's not a word, can end fairly easily. Whereas a ksuba imposes barriers that, with the dissolution of the marriage, he's going to have to pay her a certain amount. That doesn't exist in the case of a pilagesh. You don't even have the formal ritual of kiddushin. There's some discussion about whether a get is required, but fundamentally, she is like a zonah. So that's Radak's first approach, is that this is actually a pilagesh. That's his statement. Sorry?
Isn't there such a formal relationship in the Torah?
Pilagesh?
Yeah,
Avram had pilagshim. There's some debate. Sorry?
Pilagshot.
No, it says pilagshim. Livnei pilagshim, asher
l'Avraham. It's interesting.
Yeah, but that's the... I mean, that's not so strange. We have nashim also. What you raise is an interesting question, because the Rambam's ruling on the issue of pilagesh is that it can only be done by a king. And in the cases we are familiar with are all before the Torah was given. But what are you going to do if this actually is a Pilagesh. So keep in mind that the Pasuk didn't say it was a Pilagesh. He could just disagree with what Radak is saying and say it's not a Pilagesh. But also keep in mind that the Shoftim in general played fast and loose with a lot of things. So this may be, you know, such a story. Certainly, even without it here, you had it with Gidon. Gidon had a Pilagesh. Right? Unless you're going to say that a Shoftim is like a king, because there's some discussion as to why a king is different. One of the arguments for why a king should be different is that the concern in a Pilagesh relationship is that you could end up with siblings not knowing they are siblings. In a relationship like this, which dissolves so easily and people can be mobile and you end up in different places, you never know if you're actually talking to somebody who's a sibling of yours. However, if the father is the king, then everybody knows. There's a pedigree. Everybody is aware. And maybe the same thing argument can be made for the Shofet. And therefore the Shofet would have the same justification as a king for having a Pilagesh. Pilagesh is a fascinating discussion in Halacha, if you want. I can send out a link later on to a shir I gave on how Pilagesh works or does not work within Halacha. But this is one view, is that the story here was that the mother was in fact a Pilagesh, was a concubine. Within that view that she was a concubine, the argument is made to support that in Pasuk Beis the brothers say, look, you're not inheriting with us because your mother is a concubine. However, that's halachically inaccurate. The children of a concubine do inherit from their father. That's in other words, the paternal relationship is 100%, even if it wasn't with the benefit of the normal rules of halachic marriage. It
doesn't seem like they're making a ruling.
It's like
we're going to kick you out and you're not going to inherit with us.
Right. You can imagine the scene in which they say to him, you're not inheriting, and he says, what do you mean? And they say, no, you didn't get it. You're not inheriting.
Yeah.
That kind of a conversation.
But that's consistent with the reading, because the brothers are not saying you're the son of a Pilagesh. You're saying you're the son of another woman.
Yes. It's not really about being a Pilagesh. Yeah. Correct. So Radak continues, and he's the Bionison tier game. Targum Bionison says, Pundakita, which is an innkeeper. Kmoshe Tirgim Gamkin Rachav Azona Pundakita, right? If you remember the story from the beginning of Yehoshua with Rachav, he also said innkeeper. Oh, who inyan be'atzmo, ki azona kama pundakit shemafkeret atzma. He says it doesn't have to mean literally an innkeeper. It could be that it's because the innkeeper is available for everybody, so that's the zona. In other words, it just means zona. And calling it innkeeper isn't actually meant to cover that up. If you take that view, then it's clear that the inheritance argument, you know, if you take the view that it's innkeeper, like as a literal thing, that it's innkeeper, then there's no reason to justify the inheritance argument. So his mother's an innkeeper, so what? But he quickly moves into the idea that it's actually zona. And he goes on to say, "Ubatargum shel tosefta." There's an added targum on this, which goes as follows. Da hi nimusa habas bi Yisrael milakadmin. This was the practice in Israel back in ancient times. This is an added targum. It's not translating anything from the pasuk, but remember, targum is not meant to be translation per se. It often is translation, but targum is meant to be commentary. It was the way to teach the text back in a time when people spoke Aramaic more than they spoke Hebrew. So this is an added comment, saying the practice back then, in the time of Yiftach, was to avoid having a portion of land go from one tribe to another. And therefore, you weren't allowed to marry a woman from another tribe. And if a woman fell in love with a man who was not from her tribe, so she would leave her father's house without any inheritance in order to avoid the property going from one tribe to another. And people would call her innkeeper for loving a man who is not from her tribe. And that was the story of Yiftach's mother. And he goes on to say, and that's why it says you're not going to inherit, because indeed there's no inheritance from the mother's family. back to the idea, and you're not inheriting in our father's house because you're from this other woman. That's a very interesting added explanation to this. So
this is
not Targum Yonatan, although he does things like this frequently. It's just Targum Shel Tosefta. I don't know the provenance of this Targum. The Ralbag brings it here, as does the Big Deshesh, Rabbi Behafer. But here's my question overall. What's the message we're supposed to be taking away from this pedigree of Yiftach and the story of his family?
He's an absolute.
He worked from the stakes of Abimelech. We're going to take a chance at having him kill all the kids again. Because you also have the Anashim where he came again.
Right? It's true. We're setting him up like to be Abimelech all over again. Perhaps. We did note that last time, that it's sort of shades of that story. Except that here, he's the one who gets evicted. I mean, there is certainly the isolation. The fact that he's rejected by his brothers. I think that's a major lesson we're supposed to learn here. I think there's also an element of Jewish degeneracy that's being highlighted. The fact that there is this zonah in the story is not a point in our favor. So he is evicted. Now, here's an interesting question. Are his brothers younger than him or older? And give me evidence.
Really asked what Paul and son's second after the birth.
Mm-hmm. Sounds younger. So this is when they grew up that he drove from out.
Right. It sounds like they are younger than him. Right? It says that as Ari points out, it says they grew up and did this. But also it said he had sons from Eshet Gilad after it mentions Yiftach. So it suggests that they are younger, which means that there's an added level of disrespect. There's an added insult here. They kicked out not just anyone, they kicked out the first Bechor, exactly, the firstborn. Reading this, I wonder, going back last week, whether this reflects the Ammon theme. The theme of Ammon, we said, going all the way back to Ammon, daughter of Lot, is someone who's trying to do something good by doing something bad. Right? Lot's daughter producing a child with him, trying to keep the world going, but in a very, very wrong way. And of course, Lot himself offering his daughters to Sodom, right? Trying to do something, you know, to save the guests, but again, in an absurdly wrong way. And one wonders here, are they doing this under the guise of combating zinut, or combating immorality? Here's this kid who was born from the Zonah. We're going to chase him away. But they're doing it the wrong way. Because that's going to be the saga of Yiftach, or since I'm in Canada, the saga of Yiftach. Do people here say that? Saga?
Is
that
a saga. Saga.
You say saga. Mrs. Saga. Right? Okay. They
still spell it S-A-G-A, not S-A-U.
But the idea here is going to play out for Yiftach as well, of trying to do the right thing and just completely ruining it. And that's, I feel like, maybe an element in this eviction. So he goes to the land of Tov. Tov actually shows up in Shmuel Bet. I gave you the reference in source number 3 when you want to look it up. But it's in the land of Aram. So it's off to Syria territory and points east. Some suggest, Radak says it in number 4, that actually there was a guy named Tov. There was a land of someone named Tov. Tov was the founder of that land. Abarbanel says, no, it's Eretz Tova. Granted that then, as Charlie will point out, why didn't you call it Tova instead of calling it Tov? But that's what he says. He says it was good land. And it was, you know, the kind of place where you just, you know, be all right hanging out away from society. In which case, Tov is a plot element. Right? In other words, it wasn't just that he went out somewhere. He went to some good land. He's doing okay there.
Talking about Yiftach, does it matter that he was not chosen by God?
The other
Shoftim were.
Right.
He was apparently not. Like, it doesn't say nowhere that.
Well, he hasn't become a Shofet yet. He's going to become a shofet later. He's not a shofet at this stage. The Yerushalmi says, Yerushalmi in Shavuos, as explained by the commentary Alei Tamar, says that it's a land that the Jews did not take when they came into Israel, and so it was exempt from tithing, and therefore the residents viewed it as being tov. It's good, because I don't have to pay anything. No taxes. It's a tax-free state. That's right. Yes. So you have these reikim, these empty people who gather to yiftach, these people who are empty perhaps of social status, perhaps empty of character.
Perhaps inheritances, like him.
Sorry, perhaps.
Also lacking.
Lacking in inheritance. They're empty in that sense. Could well be. And what do? They live off the land, it seems. This is, after all, Eretz Tov. That's what Abarbanel says. But Rabban says, no, that's not how you manage out there. Take a look at number 7, please. I gave you some references to Reikim in general in Tanakh. But Vidmesha Yiftach Hayaman Higam, Yiftach was their leader. They went to war. Right? War doesn't have to be literal, but it means they rob people on the roads. Traders are traveling through the area. They raid the travelers. That's how they eat. And it makes sense because if you look at the end of Pasuk Gimel, you have to be a little sensitive to language here. The end of Pasuk Gimel says, "Vayislak to Yiftach Anashim Reikim." Right, these empty people gathered to Yiftach. Vayetzeu imo. They went out with him. What does "went out with him" mean? What is that? They're dating. Well, what is "went out with him"? If you remember, when Moshe talks to God in Parshas Pinchas about who the next leader of the Jews is going to be, right? Moshe turns it around on Hashem and he says, "Here's what I think you need to find to be the next Moshe." Right? It's fitting. Today was Ayin Adar, so we quote Moshe. He says, "Asher yetzei lifnehem, v'asher yavo lifnehem." Say the Mefarshim, the commentaries to that. Somebody will go out to war in front of them. Yetzei is to go out to war. So that would fit with Vayetzeu imo. They went out to fight alongside him. That would make sense. And of course, it also makes sense with the fact that he's going to be asked to lead the nation in war. He has a track record. They know he's a tough guy.
But there's a real difference between the highwayman type of enterprise that you were describing and mercenaries.
Yes.
But one is something that shows, you could argue, it has a certain amount of character attached to it. The other are just thugs.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to matter. In other words, we're going to see what Yiftach does. And in certain ways, he's going to surprise us. And in certain ways, you're going to look at it and say, yeah, thug is about right. So, yeah, you'll see. He's going to surprise us first in this very odd passage we're going to see today. But then he plays to type after that. So let's see. Pasuk Dalet. Let's see what happens here. Vayhi miyamim, after a while, vayilachamu v'nei Amon im Yisrael. Amon fights Israel. Now remember, we already saw them fight, right, in the previous parak. They started. So this is either a throwback to what happened in the previous parak. We just get this little interlude introducing Yiftach. Or alternatively, no, the previous one, God listened to us and God made sure that they went back across the Yarden to where they had been. And now they're back. When they fought with Israel, the elders of Gilad went to go get Yiftach from the land of Tov. And they said to him, we would like you to be our katzin. We have to explain the word katzin. Katzin in modern Hebrew, you know, is a captain in the army, but we'll have to talk about what a katzin is. We would like you to be our katzin, and then we'll be able to fight Amon. What happened to the regular katzin? It feels like he's like their emergency backup goaltender. Not to mock the Leaf fans too much. Apparently they're completely unready for war. The Jews are just hanging out, and there's a threat from Amon. And they decide, let's go get somebody who is going to be some kind of army officer is the default assumption for a katzin. So look what he does back. Vayomer Yiftach lezikne Gilad. Yiftach says to them, Halo atem sinei semo seiv atagershuni mi beis avi. Excuse me, is that someone at the door? You know, the ones who ran me off, right? Why are you coming to me now when you're in trouble? I'm not in trouble, I'm doing just fine. They say to him, this is why we're back, because we need you to fight against Ammon. You will be the Rosh of all of Gilad. That sounds good. Right? That sounds like bigger than Katzin. Yeah. Katzin is a military position. Rosh sounds like it's a political position. Vayomer Yiftach lezikne Gilad. So Yiftach says to them, here are the terms. Im mishivim atem osi lehilachem bivnei Ammon, if you're going to bring me back to fight with Ammon, v'nasan Hashem osam lefanai, and God gives them before me, anochi ayelachem l'rosh, I will indeed be your head. I accept your offer, it sounds like. Vayomer zikne Gilad al Yiftach, Hashem yeshomea benosenu imlochet varcha kein naaseh. The people of Gilad say, deal. Done. Vayelach Yiftach im ziknei Gilad, vayasimu ha'amos sawalayhem l'rosh ulekatzin. Yiftach goes with them, they make him a rosh and a katzin. Vayedaber Yiftach is called the Rav lifnei Hashem ba'mitzpah, and Yiftach spoke his words before God in mitzpah. So there's a whole lot here that we need to understand, right? What is strange here? What requires explanation?
What was it about Yiftach that they would go to him? Like other than what you just said before about being a bandit, does he have any... There's nothing that says that he's a...
Not a thing. Not a thing. He's just the most violent guy we know.
How do we know that he's even violent, other than this word?
Bayitsu'imo is really all we have. It's true. You know, if I wasn't biased against Yiftach, because I know the story of his daughter coming up, I would have said, this is such a nice rags-to-riches kind of story. Kind of, you know, if you, since Michael's English, right, a Byronic hero type of guy who's been like the outcast and the anti-hero, and now we turn to him and say, Evan Moasu Habonim, right? You've got to save us. But this may just be the more realistic version of the way things work. Which is to say, society spits at him until they need him. And then it's like, you know, wait, we need you. Come help us. Like, that's the way things go.
Why do they make him head before the conditions are fulfilled?
His own condition.
Right, he said, yeah. I'll come back, and if I win, I'll be the head, and then they go and they make him head.
Yeah. Good. That's a definite question. I'm going to ask you another question here. What's the difference between Katzin and Rosh, right? And if Pasuk Chet is really a response to his charge of, hey, you kicked me out, did you have to go all the way to Rosh? Right? You invited him in and said, can you run our army? He said, you know, you kicked me out. They said, all right, president. Right. I mean, there was nothing in between. Like, two-star general. Like, you couldn't have done something? You know, it's just like, jumping all the way to this position is so strange. And Yiftach, what is he adding in Pasuk Tet?
He has to win.
Basically, he's introducing Hashem's support of his position.
He's introducing God, and that's definitely a key part of it. But I think we need to look more closely at what exactly it is that he's doing. And then I also am curious, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, what did he say before God in Mitzvah? I don't know. So, let's see what we can get here. First of all, I said last week, I quoted from Professor Elitzur in the Dan Mikra, that this idea of calling upon the outcasts was actually standard in society back then. And I think that's supported by the way they have no shame whatsoever about doing this. It also happens later on in Shmuel Bet, in Perek Yud, Ammon is going to do the same thing in their war against David. As a matter of fact, Ralbag, makes another one of those comments that I just really enjoy. If you take a look at source number 8, you remember his last one that I quoted you about Abimelech standing too close to the building. So look at this one. He says, Hasheni, the second lesson you can get out of this story. Hulahudia she'ein ra'ui l'rdofa chalushim. He says, you know, don't beat up on people who are weak. Ki ein bashar ezra sam, just because they lack support at the gate. Halo tira mashakarel zigne gilad. Look what happened to the elders of Gilad, right? You made fun of the guy, you kicked him out, and now you needed him. So be careful who you insult. That's Ralbag's comment here, which thank you, Ralbag. And they make him an offer. So I want to track what it is that they're, you know, offering in these situations. Based on the way the Mefarshim explain what these positions are, and in particular Malbim, because he's so attentive to language. So look at 9. He tells you what a katsin is. Katsin, he takes from the word katzeh, the edge. Katsin is the one who stands at the katzeh. Hakatsin hu ha'omeid b'ktzeh ha'machaneh. He stands at the edge of the camp, machmas chashivuso u'ma'alaso, because of his great stature, Bigvura, because of his might, Oba Osher, his wealth, Oba Chochmor, his knowledge, Hagam She'eno Rosh u'Moshel Aleihem. He's not a political leader. He is just the officer everybody is going to listen to. That's the way Malbim reads Katzin, and that's what they want him to be. He'll be a leading warrior, and we will fight. That's their that's the offer that they gave here. But here's something interesting. And this is one of those things that, because we're doing this on a weekly basis, it's easy to miss. Go back to Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud Chet, the last sentence in chapter 10. You see that? This was the first time that the war started. And there we said that the Sarei Gilad said to each other, who is it who will fight Amon? He will be the head for all Yoshvei Gilad. Well, now we've apparently backed down from it. Maybe Yiftach is aware of that. He knows that I had a better deal on the table. So he's going to negotiate. You know? Sorry?
Pasuk ends with Mitzvah.
Yes. And he goes back to Mitzvah, correct. I mean, Mitzvah in general was, and we've seen this before, an important gathering place for them, but I'm going to come back to Mitzvah. We've got a lot to talk about Mitzvah. So, let me just pause here for a second. Military success is the criterion for our military leader? I mean, it makes sense. But consider that we have also associated military success in Chumash, certainly, and in Tanakh, as being associated with piety. Abraham goes after the four kings, and he is successful. Yosef's brothers in Egypt, right? That whole saga, in the Midrash about how they were going to fight with Yosef, and they're positioned as being very strong. Granted that Shimon and Levi, not necessarily presented as being so righteous. Moshe is considered to be this mighty warrior. He's going to fight Og. We do tend to do that, and as another example, Moshe picks Yoshua to fight Amalek. What do I know about Yoshua? He never leaves Moshe's tent. That's going to make him a good warrior, right? So much so that, interestingly, the Medrash that I brought you in number 10, Bamidbar Rabbah, says that Moshe selects Yoshua to lead the war against Amalek in order to give him some experience. He should have some kind of military experience. Sure. See Amalek over there? Go fight them. That's your military experience. There's no step before that. I'm asking the question, because does the fact that he is considered to have military success say anything about his character? I think the answer is no. Like we've already said, that Yiftach is considered to just be a guy who fights people. But you sort of wonder about the role of military prowess and whether there's anything else to it. In any case, Yiftach says to them that, you know, you sent me away. He makes this very direct accusation. Right? Abarbanel says either his brothers are there among the people who are inviting him, or you guys knew about it and didn't stop my brothers from doing this, right? You think of like the Kamsa Bar Kamsa story, right? He kicked me out of the party. We're watching when they kicked me out of the party. So he blames everybody for this. So they, as Malbim notes, go back to their language from the end of Perek Yud and say, all right, fine, we'll make you the Rosh. You will actually lead. You're not just the you're not just going to be the katzin. Okay, you will be the you will be the leader. And then Yiftach comes back to them in Pasuk Tet, and what Yiftach says to them, as Malbim reads it and Abarbanel reads it that way, is to say, did I bring it? Yeah, I brought it on the sheet in number 12. Take a look. What honor are you giving me? How exactly are you repairing what my brothers did to me? You think that by telling me I should fight Ammon, and if I win you'll make me the head, and that's your reward to make up for everything that was done to me? I know that if I succeed, I become the head. You're not giving me anything. Of course, if I succeed, I'm going to be the head. If I save them, of course I'm the next leader. That's it. That's a no-brainer, says Abarbanel, says Malbim. Yiftach is saying that the of course I'm going to lead if I win, whether you like it or not. He is countering their offer. Their offer was, all right, fine, we'll make you the head. And he says, what kind of offer is that? That's a given. To which the people come back to him in Pasuk Yud, and they say, Hashem yeshomea beinoseinu umlochit varcha kein naaseh, as God is our witness, we're going to do what you say. What does that mean? Says Malbim, as well as Abarbanel. I brought it to you in Abarbanel in source number 13. That he can decree as he wishes, they will willingly go along with it. Therefore, they made him the leader even before the battle. So it's a three-stage thing. First, they offer Katzin. He says, there was a better deal in Perek Yud. They said, all right, fine, Rosh. He says, I'm a Rosh anyway if I win. They said, all right, you're a Rosh now. That's the that's where the, that Abarbanel and Malbim structure the parak. I also found it interesting that he invoked Hashem. If Hashem helps me succeed, if you had asked me what I would expect to see from, you know, this bandit who's living out in the land of Tov, who was kicked out by his brothers and has his questionable heritage, I don't think I would have expected that. This plays in a little bit on the positive side of Yiftach. He's not such a terrible person. I think that's interesting. So in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Yiftach repeats the terms of the agreement. That's the way the commentators read what he did, when it says he spoke all of his words before Hashem in Mitzpah. Why Mitzpah? So Professor Eli Tzur says that's his home. That's where Yiftach lives. His basis for that is Pasuk Lamed Daled. If you jump to sentence 34, it says it explicitly. Vayavo Yiftach HaMitzpah El Beito. So he went to Mitzpah, and in Mitzpah he reiterated the terms of the agreement. That makes sense. Rashi, though, floats another idea. He says, back at the end of Perek Yud, they gathered in Mitzpah, as how we noted, right, when they made their initial argument. So Rashi writes in source number 14, L'makom sh'nesfu kulam, the place they all had gathered, Shashchina shora al ro tzibur. Hashem is there. If the Jews gather as a group, Hashem will be present, and that's what he's doing. It's the Shechina, the place where Hashem will be present. Radak adds that Mitzpah was a place where Hashem was present for us back in Yahushua. Remember how, we learned this ages ago, when the Jews come in under Yahushua and they fight their wars, at one stage, Yavin, Melech Canaan, gathers a whole bunch of nations to fight us all at once, and Hashem saves us from them in Mitzpah. And afterwards, Mitzpah keeps showing up as a gathering place for the Jews. Technically speaking, Mitzpah just means what?
A lookout.
Right. So fast, a scout. It's just a lookout point. But it's taken as the Mitzpah. there was a lookout spot where things went really well, and now we're going to continue using that spot. So Radak here, number 15, says, Olatam k'moshe perashti b'sefer Yehoshua, ki hi ha-mitzpah sh'noadu ha-melachim li-lachim im Yehoshua. He says, the reason could be what I said in Yehoshua, that this mitzpah was where the kings wanted to fight Yehoshua, m'bnei ha-tshuva g'dolosh, ha-isasham, because of the great victory that happened there, ha-ya ha-minav b'Yisrael li-kaveit sham. There was a practice of gathering there, v'sham mizbeach, u'beis tefillah, be'ad mizbeach, a place to daven, u'osa mitzpah, u'anshei giladim yiftach, l'daber sham divrayhem l'fnei Hashem v'mitzpah. So that's where they went, so that it's formal before God that we are coming up with this agreement.
So we've said that, one is that he's outside of Eretz Israel.
Yeah.
Two, we said he's nomadic.
Well, he was living in Tov. Right, according to this, he's now got a new home in Mitzpah, apparently.
Right, so it changes the whole story of Yivtah.
To a certain extent, not to mention, he's actually going to go back to Tov to prepare for war.
Right.
So we're not there yet. That's coming up in Pasuk Chavtet. So that's why I'm not so clear on Professor Elitzur's idea that he's living in Mitzpah, but you can't ignore the fact that it says his home in Mitzpah.
Right, that may be after when he's doing the battle plans, he moves.
Or you know what it could be. You know what else it could be, come to think of it. I hadn't thought about this before, but maybe that's where his father's house is. No, as part of this is I get to go home. I wonder if that's not the... I wonder if that's maybe why. He has, his own home is in Mitzpah, is in Tov, and his father's house is in Mitzpah, and that's where he's going there. I wonder if that is a possibility.
He says Mitzpah is also mentioned in Bereshit.
Where?
Yaakov and Davan. They're greater than
they. Yeah. Ba'mitzvah asher amar yitzvah Hashem ben yu b'necha. That's not necessarily the same mitzvah, though. Because that would be further east.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Right. I would think it would be further east, but yeah, it's an interesting point.
So this mitzvah is in Israel proper. It's not east of the Jordan?
I believe that, well, the question of where they are at this point is a good one. I think it's still east of the Jordan, because that's where the fight seems to be going on with Ammon. But I can't prove that. But it still wouldn't be as far east as where Lavan would have been, I would think. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. Geography is the sort of thing that Professor Elitzur would be paying close attention to. But what I get out of this whole story here and this whole build-up really feeds into the point that I brought you before in previous weeks from Professor Rosenson, which is, go back to Gidon, right? Gidon did not pursue power, whether he accepted it in the end or not. He didn't pursue it. Abimelech went looking for it and led the nation with violence. Tola, we said, learned from what happened with Abimelech, who was just a righteous shofet and did not start trouble. Yair then goes back towards the Abimelech route. He emphasizes the wealth and the status of his kids, and now Yiftach goes that route as well. He demands authority, and it's not going to end well. So you're getting this kind of arc in terms of learning the lesson and then forgetting the lesson, which, you know, is human history. So let's see what happens. Now we get Yiftach's surprise. Pasuk Yudbeis. If I had been writing this story, I would have expected that the very next thing is Yiftach raises an army and goes to attack Ammon. Right? That would be logical. Vayishlach Yiftach malachim, amelach b'nei Ammon. Yiftach instead sends agents to the king of Ammon, Lemor, saying, Mali valach ki basa elai lilachim v'yartzi. What's between us that you've come to fight in my land? It's diplomacy, right? This is a diplomatic initiative. What's this all about? So the king of Ammon says to the agents, because the Jews took my land. When? When you came out of Egypt. May Arnon, from the Arnon. Arnon is a body of water that is the southern end of the land of Ammon. If you look back at Sefer Bamidbar, you get all the details there. Va'ad ha-yabok, to the Abok, which is a body of water that is the northern boundary of Ammon, so that's the southern boundary and the northern boundary, Va'ad HaYarden, to the Jordan, which is their western boundary. Right? There are no real eastern boundaries, as we've discussed before, because it just basically fades into desert. Ve'ata Hashiva es hen b'shalom. So, give our land back. We want our land back. And if not, we're going to block the train. That's the threat. Vayosef od Yiftach vayishlach malachim amelach b'nei Ammon. So Yiftach sends messengers back to the king of Ammon. Vayomer lo, and he says to him, Ko Amar Yiftach, which, you know, is a little bit... There's a certain majesty he's trying to lend himself here. Thus spake Yiftach. Lo lakach Yisrael es eretz Moab ves eretz b'nei Ammon. He says, you must be confused. Israel didn't take your land. When the Jews came out of Egypt, they went through the Midbar to Yamsuf. They went to Kadesh. And then they sent messengers to the king of Edom. Lemur, saying, we want to cross through your land. And he didn't listen to us. We sent messengers to Moab. They didn't listen. By the way, it's interesting. The account in Bamidbar, remember, if you remember the geography, the Jews are coming up east of Israel from the south. And so what they're doing is, if you imagine the Jordan here, and they're working their way up, and each way they're like knocking, you know, can I go through, can I go through? But they're not allowed to fight against Mishpacha. They're not allowed to fight against Edom, they're not allowed to fight against Moab. And so they just keep on going until finally... they end up finding the Amori, who are not family. And the Amori will let us through. We say, okay, fine, I'll fight you. And that's how we end up getting in. But the but in Bamidbar, it doesn't say they sent to Moab. What happens in Bamidbar when they get to Moab?
Moab comes out to greet them.
Moab comes out to them, right? The story with Balak, the cursing of Bnei Yisrael and or attempt to and so on. It's only in Chumash Devarim that we're told that no, the Jews actually did send to Moab also, which is clearly what's being channeled here when he says, "Yeah, we sent to Moab, they didn't let us through." Vayeshev Yisrael b'Kadesh, the Jews dwelled in Kadesh. Pasuk Yuches, Vayelech b'Midbar. This is, you know, describing still our ancestors' trip. They went through the wilderness. Vayasav es eretz Edom. They went around Edom. They didn't go through. Vayas eretz Moab and around Moab. Vayavoni mizrach shemesh le'eretz Moab. They came east of Moab. Vayachanun, which is the same as Vayachanu, be'ever Arnon, camped on the other side of the Arnon. V'lo ba'u b'gvul Moab, ki Arnon g'vul Moab. We didn't enter Moab's territory. Arnon is the boundary of Moab. And then we sent messengers to the Amori. And we said, let's go through your land. Which is almost a direct lift out of Sefer Devarim. Right? The only difference is instead of Elohe'emin, it's Lo Natan. But other than that, it's the same pasuk. Sichon would not allow the Jews to go through his land. Vayasov Sichon es kolamo. Sichon gathered his nation to fight. Vayachanu biyatza. They camped in Yahatz. Vayilachem im Yisrael. And they fought with Israel. Vayitein Hashem Elokei Yisrael es Sichon ves kolamo biyad Yisrael vayakum. And God gave Sichon and his entire nation into the hands of Israel, and they struck them. Vayirash Yisrael es kol eretz ha'amori yoshev aretz ahi. And the Jews got all the Amori land. And what was that? Pasuk Chavez. Vayirishu eis kol gevul ha'amori. They got all the boundaries of the Amori. May Arnon, from Arnon in the south. Vadayabok tiyabok in the north. Right, does sound familiar? Min ha'midbar, from the midbar that's in the east. Vadayardain to the Jordan in the west. They, in other words, the land that you claim was yours, that we took from you, we actually got that land off of the Amori. I don't know what you're talking about, but he's not done. Ve'ata, and now, Hashem Elokei Yisrael harishas ha'amori b'nei Amo Yisrael. God has given us this land from the Amori. Ve'ata tiroshenu. You should now inherit it. What? We had to do the hard work, drive off the Amori. Now you're going to take it from us? Hello, Eisa sher yorishcha kamosh Elohecha zosirash. You have a God. His name is Kamosh. Go ahead. Get whatever Kamosh gives you. And whatever Hashem takes care of for us, that's what we'll get. And then he says, Are you somehow better than Balak, who tried his hand against us? Haro Ravim Yisrael im Nilchom Nilcham Bam, the one who fought with us, tried to wage war against us? B'sheves Yisrael b'chashbon u'vivnoseh u'var'or u'vivnoseh v'chol ha'arim asher al yedei arnon shlosh me'os shana. And then he shifts gears. He says, you know, we've been living in these cities, Cheshbon, Aroer, all these cities by the Arnon. 300 years we've been here. Umadolo itzal tampa Yisrael. Where you been? V'anochi lo chatasi lach. I didn't do anything to you. V'atah usay tira'ali lachem bi. You're starting with me. So he says, Yishvod Hashem HaShofet Hayom Bein Bnei Yisrael Bein Bnei Amon. May God judge between us and you. And it concludes, V'lo Shema Melech Bnei Amon El Divrei Yiftach Asher Shalach Elav. Shockingly, this massive attempt at diplomacy is a failure. They were not interested. How many different arguments did Yiftach provide here?
Provided one of Chazaka and one of God giving it to him, and the others you have no claim. So three that I can see.
It's not really a Chazaka claim.
Well, he's saying we've been here for 300 years and you haven't taken it.
There's a legal term for that, isn't it?
Not really. I mean, yes, there is, but sorry. Not entirely. The way Chazaka works in the Gemara is, if you live on someone's land for a certain period of years, and then he comes back and says, hey, you're living on my land, you can say to him, I bought it off you ages ago, but it's been so long, more than 3 years, I haven't held on to the document since then. I assumed if you were going to make a claim, you would have made a claim by now. And that's acceptable. It's called Chezkas Gimel Shanim L'Chazak of 3 years. But it's predicated on you having a claim of, I bought it off of you. If he comes to you and says, you're sitting on my land, and you say, well, I've been living here for 300 years because I kicked you off originally.
It's adverse possession.
Right. That doesn't work. That's not acceptable. The legal term you're thinking of is a different concept. It's called squatter's rights.
Adverse possession.
Right. And that is using the fact that you lived there in a way that if there was an owner, they would have complained.
It's got to be open, notorious.
Notorious.
And,
yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. There were five things I learned.
Yeah, I remember when Karen was taking the bar.
Law school. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one type is establishing your claim by the fact that you live there. The other is saying, this is just why I don't have my proof anymore. I didn't hold on to the deed. But to go back to our idea here, his first claim is, we didn't take any land of yours at all. I don't know what you're talking about. We didn't start with anybody. That's number one. If you want to know how we got the land, we got it off of the Amori, which you will recall from Rashi and Sefer Bamidbar, based on the Psukim there, is that the Amori took the land off of Ammon. Right? The language of the Gemara is Ammon u'Moav tiaru b'Sichon. Sichon conquered the land of Ammon and Moav, and we're allowed to go to war against Sichon, king of the Amori. So he says, you're fighting with the wrong guy. It was the Amori we got it off of. And that was legit.
Is that a little bit like a Gonev Miganav? Is that, in other words,
it would be if it was considered Gneva. The problem is that historically, if you fought a war against somebody and you won, that was how you came into possession of land. You know, so their statement is, there was a war, we won fair and square, now it's ours.
The fact that he includes a statement indicating that they had attempted, they simply wanted to peacefully pass through the land of Sichon, indicates sort of it sort of undercuts any argument that they would have today about the fact that they are trying to take something in with some malicious intent or whatever.
Well, I mean, if I were the lawyer for Ammon, my response would be, it's all well and good that you tried to go through peacefully and then you weren't allowed through, so I understand that may have upset you, but it didn't entitle you to fight a war. You know? But the fact that you can't get passage through the land is not my problem.
Wasn't Sichon who gathered his army to fight?
Right. See, that's the real response is, Ve'asov Sichon es kol amo. Sichon wanted to fight with us. That's really, I think, the better way to read it. But there's more here to his claim. He also says, we got it off of the Amori. We did the hard work. Now you're just going to grab it off of us? The Gemara talks about this. The Gemara talks about cases in Roman times. The more, today this is much discussed in terms of Holocaust era items. The Gemara talks about what if the Romans got property from a Jew? They took it. And then a Jew buys it off of the Roman. Does the Jew now have to return it to the original owner? Because after all, it was taken from the original owner, illegitimately. Same question that comes up in terms of recovery of items from the Holocaust. There's a lot of literature on that in Halacha. So he says, we did the hard work of getting it off of the Amori. You don't get to now just take it away from us. That doesn't work. Then he offers you a third argument. Your God, Kamosh. Right? Tell me something. Is this the first time we've seen Kamosh? Obviously, I'm asking the question. The answer is no. But Kamosh is really interesting. Because Kamosh shows up in the Chumash. Kamosh is the god of Moab, not Ammon. Isn't that weird? Especially when you go back to Pasuk Tet Vav, sentence 15, and we throw in this piece about Israel never took the land of Moab and Ammon. I thought Moab wasn't in this conversation. I thought it was Ammon. Why did you mention Moab at all? Right? And then he gives you the other argument of, by the way, we've been here for 300 years, and where have you been? So you have, by my count, four different arguments that he's presenting in this. And we need to talk about this. So first of all, I noted for you on the sheet, this isn't the first time in the Torah that there's an attempt at diplomacy first. Right? Yaakov with Esav. Sends the message, Im Lavan Garti, and all of that. Tries to diffuse things. Moshe trying to get them to let him through with Edom, with the Emori, and then it's recorded in Devarim with Moab. The Jews trying to build the second Beit HaMikdash. When Tatnai comes from Persian headquarters and says, where's your paperwork to allow you to build this building? They go through a whole presentation on the history of their suffering and how Cyrus allowed them to come back, and now we're allowed to come back, we're allowed to build. They go through this whole attempt at diplomacy with Tatnai to convince him that they have the right to build the Beis HaMikdash. It's pretty rare in all these cases that the other side actually cares about our narrative. Like, we give them our whole story and they're like, yeah, thanks, but no. But it's a standard diplomatic tactic. Abarbanel notes it here. If you take a look at Abarbanel, did I bring him? Actually, no, I did not bring him. No, sorry. I don't know why I thought that I had, but I did not. But Abarbanel talks about this as a standard sort of diplomatic tactic. There's also, Rav David Zvi Hoffman brings a Medrash Tanoim, which I also thought I had on the sheet, but it's not here. It's too. Oh, no, there it is. There it is. Yeah, yeah. No, 8:17 was just the business about. Oh, that was the quote that I gave you. Amon Moab Tiaru B'Sichon, about Sichon conquering the land of Amon Moab. That's the Gemara in 17. 18 is Abarbanel describing the diplomacy. Zachar sheyiftach achrei shu sam aleihem larosh asak min hagamlachim v'hasarim. Now that he's the head, Yiftach did what kings and nobles do. He sent for peace, right? But the Medrash Tanoim in number 19 is more fascinating. The Torah says, when you go to war, v'karasa eleha l'shalom, you shall sue for peace. So the Medrash says, Godol hu ha-shalom. Sha'af milchama tzvichin shalom. Shalom is so great that even when you go to war, you have to look for peace. As the Pasuk says, v'karasa eleha l'shalom, and they give you the example of Moshe sending messengers asking for permission to go through people's land to get to Israel. V'omer, and it gives you our Pasuk, v'yishlach yiftach malachim, ha-malach b'nei Amon, no more. He was fulfilling v'karasa eleha l'shalom. He's suing for peace. This would be consistent with the observation of the Chida, Right? The Chida said that Yiftach went to Eretz Tov in order to avoid a fight. So look at him now. He's again trying to avoid a fight. It's very interesting. Two more notes before we get into Yiftach.
Trying to avoid the fight, or just trying to be systematic and diplomatic, and try and go to the last degree before he starts fighting.
Well, isn't it the same thing? What's the difference?
Okay.
No, I think.
Yeah, right.
His condition for being leader is that he would conquer over them.
Yeah.
Not that he would have a peace treaty.
Yeah, I don't know if he thinks it's going to work.
Right, so I'm saying, in line with what Michael's saying, is this is just to say that he's done his due diligence or whatever, but his intent is to go to battle.
Right. I hear it. It's just that it's odd because he's the only one we find do this in Shoftim. Right? I mean, we've got 15 Shoftim in this book. I don't think any of them go for diplomacy first. It's certainly not presented as going for diplomacy first. The closest is Shimshon, who wants to marry one of the Plishtim.
But he's going in with strength. I mean, it describes him as a Gibor Chayil.
Yes.
And he's going with confidence. I mean, he has no doubt he's going to win.
Right.
Which we haven't had with the other Shoftim.
Right. That's fair. You know what else is interesting here? This is the only time, Professor Elitzur makes this point, I think it was him, this is the only time in which we get what the Knanim are thinking in Sefer Shoftim. Meaning, I've made this point multiple times, that in Sefer Shoftim, everything that happens is because God makes it happen. And then we get none of the background. This one rated here. Why? Because Hashem was angry because the Jews had sinned, and therefore Hashem sent them. No explanation of what their motivation was. We can conjecture, but we don't know. Here, Amon says, you took our land. So why suddenly did we decide to present their point of view? Why does their point of view matter here more than elsewhere? So I think from a story perspective, it gives us their approach in order to enable Yiftach to explain, no, we actually didn't take it from them. We got it off of the Amori. So it gives us the opportunity to present our point of view. But I think from a philosophical perspective, I think it also invites us to think about our original entry into the land and what we were supposed to do. Meaning, well, this journey that Amon is talking about and that Yiftach is talking about, at that point, we were supposed to come in and settle the land in God's name and build up a society. The Canaanim were supposed to become Noahides and observe the seven Noahide laws. And none of that has happened. And so it isn't only a reminder of 300 years ago, we fought wars against Canaan because we had no choice in order to be able to get through. We had to fight the Amori. It's also reminding us of what the mindset was back then. I think that's also a piece of this conversation.
What the mindset was.
Meaning, when we came in 300 years ago, we had a job to do. Mm. And we didn't do it.
I remember you discussing that when you were discussing the ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, because that's all of a piece. This was what was supposed to happen and has not happened. Yeah. So Yiftach makes his arguments here, but I think it's already close enough to, I think it's time for, we'll pause with that. And again, no shiur next week, but everyone should have a chag sameach, and then we'll pick up, God willing, in 2 weeks.
Doesn't that make sense?